when the problem is just as significant if it's a 2-year-old.
Yeah, I think we hear about it more when it's a newborn, kidnapped from nursery, but which may be why it first showed up this way.
This is Michael. We have cases of demented elderly that are dropped off by the transport service at the doctor's office, and after the visit are picked up by the wrong transport service because they identify themselves as the wrong person, and then they go to the wrong place, and it's a big mess, and the family wonders where they went.
So that raises almost the issue of it doesn't matter if there was malintent or not. There was the wrong thing, I mean, and potentially put that person in danger.
Yeah, I don't really care much about the blame. I think that's
Right.
sort of another step later on in the process. And if we say, oh yeah, well it happens all the time, we can't be bothered to check on it, then maybe it isn't your problem to check. Maybe you can't even check on it. That's again for someone else to determine. But just getting a tabulation of how whether it's a national problem or not, to me would be the intent.
And it's a matter of safeguarding people that can't protect themselves.
Yeah.
For me, again, the question for most of these is not whether it's blameful or shameful, but whether we can accurately and precisely tabulate it.
Doesn't that get into the issue of ambiguity?
Yeah.
It's
If we can
less
define
ambiguous with an infant. It's more ambiguous in some of the other examples. You can run into trouble where we talked about in that first meeting about, family member A versus family member B and who really has custody, who doesn't, of their aged parent. Just caution about the ambiguity.
Well, what was the and adding another one similar to this, but beyond infants and putting it out there then for public comment?
When you say another one, you mean, would it be person or patient discharged to wrong person? Just patient, not any age or further specification on it?
It could be that, or we could leave the infant one as is to emphasize infant, the infant issue. But I don't know then what the other word would be for the second one, non-infant or any other patient. I don't know. Maybe it's best to make it a generic one. I mean, these all are going out for comment again, correct?
That's correct, yes.
I think as long as the notes support our discomfort about the ambiguity on some of this, I think it can go out. Because I don't think it's cut and dry. Some of the examples Michael gave were very good, very elegant, but there's a lot of other examples that can cause problems for organizations.
And those examples we'd want to include in the implementation guidance.
Correct.
I do think that Michael's point about this group not worrying about the consequences of the reporting to be particularly well taken here, just reporting to make sure that we have national information about the incidents is really important.
Any further comments on this? Or hearing none, we'll put this in the Survey Monkey for people to comment, and we'll see what the field has to say about this. I'm sure we'll get a lot of comments on this one.
Okay.
Sally, from this point, I'm going to let you walk through folks on these, because I know I'll be leaving in about, probably before this next one is done.
Okay. Lindsay, my screen is not showing. Can you make sure that...
Sure, I'll pull that back up. Sorry, my computer's having an issue.
Okay. And now mine is too, because we're all linked.
Okay, it should be back up and running.
Okay, great. Great. Okay, great. Thank you, Lindsay. Okay, looks like the next one, patient death or serious disability associated with patient elopement. What did the TAPS think on this one?
From the skilled perspective, this is a huge issue for us, always has been. It's central to what we are up to. We want to define elopement and include the caveats as to the differences in state definitions as well. But it is important.
And same on the ambulatory side, but we thought it was relevant, particularly with certain psychiatric populations. But we wanted clarification of the time window between the elopement and the death or serious disability to sort of have some boundaries on it.
Has ZINQF previously defined elopement?
No, not specifically for this.
Okay.
I guess I'd be interested for... the folks from the states, how have people practically applied the kind of boundary issue?
Well, from the skilled tip, we just heard different opinions from the different members as to how some states spent considerable time in defining what elopement was and what those criteria were, and then some of the other members didn't have any clue as to what a general description was or how their state applied that definition.
This is Michael. I have two issues. One is the time frame, and the other is that there are some people that are custodial and some people are not. And I think you can define who really is in a fiduciary responsibility of some kind over a patient, and when you're in the office environment, there's a lot of people in your waiting room that you don't have any custodial responsibility for. And regarding the time, if a person walks out of your facility in the winter and they wander around 3 days and they're hypothermic and they're found under a bridge and then they come back and you put them back in shape, then I guess under this you wouldn't report that. So for me, the reporting threshold is a problem here. Death or serious disability doesn't make as much sense to me here as the fact that you had a person in your custody and your provisions for keeping good control over them broke and they got away. To me, that imposes a risk. They wouldn't be in your custody if there weren't a risk. So that for me, I would rather broaden this one to include a person, an at-risk person who's in your custody, got away, and for that reason, they experienced more risk. And then that would annihilate the problem for me about AMA. If we talked about it that way.
This is Diane. I think your comments touch on a few different issues, some of which we've tried to deal with and some of which we haven't. We have talked about the AMA issue, and we've, in our definition, we exclude adults with decision-making capacity. So if someone has that capacity to make the decision and makes a conscious decision to leave, we don't consider that to be an elopement if they're leaving against medical advice. And your other issue about people waiting in a waiting room, it seems like such a basic question, but we've been trying to come up with a good definition recently of what is a patient and when does care begin. So if you have somebody who has come to your ED, they haven't yet been triaged, they haven't seen anybody, they aren't under any care yet, do you consider them to be a patient? And would they then fall under something like this category? We haven't finalized that definition. I think we would lean towards no, because we would say that care begins at the point when you go through some sort of an intake process or are seen by a member of a care team, and that's the point at which you are considered to be a patient and under the care of the facility. But I think you raise a couple of issues that are problematic with this one. We've also had the question about reportability and duration. There have been cases where we've had an elopement and a patient has disappeared and the facility just doesn't know what happened to them afterwards. They never find out. So it's not always possible to capture those serious disabilities or death. It's only if the facility actually becomes aware of it, which they don't in all cases. And that's obviously true of several of these events.
Now, nursing homes have their own responsibility with regards to the survey process. So again, elopements are captured in a variety of different ways. Maybe not as we're talking about it here with NQF, but I can assure you that there are processes in place to monitor for elopements in long-term care.
Well, it seems to me one of the key elements missing from this definition is that the facility had accepted a responsibility. Whether you settle that by calling not a patient before they cross some line or after, or I guess maybe Cynthia would help us here by coming up with a language that says there's some point at which you really have assumed the duty of custody or care for an incapacitated or incompetent person or minor.
Well, one possibility is to take a look at the state operations manuals for the definitions and, again, see what the reporting criteria are in long-term care based on the state operations manual that the facilities are under. And that might help us move us along on this.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I think that last suggestion is a good one, to look at the state operations manual, because in and of itself, the word custody has a very specific legal context. So I'm not sure you'd want to use that here unless you could support it with another definition from someplace else.
What about the time limit concept that some of you have raised? One of the TAPs recommended the 24-hour time rule. Are people comfortable with that? Do you think that's working, or are there events that are going to fall outside of this that it wouldn't capture?
I don't like it. If they run away, get hit by a truck, and die 2 days later of a ruptured spleen, I would still want to know.
I guess the issue, this is Greg, I think the issue is going to be where do we draw the line? And 24 hours, I think, was chosen out of convenience. But thoughts on how we're, because you can't have it open-ended sense either. So
I think you need to set a cutoff, and you know you're going to miss some. But, you know, other, like you said, Greg, you can't leave it open-ended because, you know, they could die a week later from something completely, you know, unrelated, or a month later or a year later.
Well, we have associated here. I would put more maybe war weight on the associated and define associated tightly by saying direct causal chain. You know, wouldn't have happened otherwise if they hadn't eloped.
This is Helen Lau. I have a question. Maybe we are reading too much into this. How it defined here is says a patient death of serious disability associated with patient elopement. They're not asking every time when patient elope you report. They're only asking if that happens. So if that happens, sometimes you might find out like 48 hours later or maybe a week later from the newspaper in some physician office or in some NIF area. So maybe we need to have some more clarification. Are we talking about every time when they elope that we expect them to report, or is it when we find out that the condition happened, the patient died, then we expect them to report?
So it's currently written, it's only if they die or they have a serious disability.
Exactly. And I hear the discussion so far is more geared towards to every time when they elope, what is the time limit? When do we need to report? Maybe I heard that wrong.
Yeah, this is great. I thought what we were discussing more is about the event. So the patient elopes. How far out is it that we're going to say that this would be an SRE? So, for example, the example given earlier, 48 hours later, the patient's hit by a vehicle and dies as a result of that, versus dies within 24 hours, versus dies 1 week later. I think that's the crux of it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
I'm gonna have to sign out. This is Greg, but I would say, you know, to me, although I think the 24 hours will miss some. I guess I feel that it's relatively clean. And that's not to say that there aren't going to be times when 1 week after the patient leaves, we find out they died within 24 hours, and then we would be obligated to report it as an SRE. Yet if the patient died a week after they eloped, we would not be. And yes, we'll miss some things, but I think for practicality, the 24 hours is a compromise and a reasonable one. And with that, I'm going to sign off and let you duke it out. Just one thing to remind the committee is we do need to get through this list. There's about an hour left. I have great faith in Sally's ability to run you through this, but should we not get across that finish line, we would need to schedule a follow-up call to finish up this work so that we can then go to the SurveyMonkey and give a product to the NQF that they can bring forward in the process.
Thanks, Greg. Does anyone want to comment on, I guess Greg thinks the 24-hour is clean, but I'm unclear what that would mean if it's 24 hours. If someone gets hit by a car within 24 hours of leaving, yet they don't die for another week, that is captured or is not captured in this?
Well, it also includes serious disability. So you don't have to die in order for this to be reported. If you're seriously disabled within the 24-hour period, I think I agree with Greg. I think there needs to be a cutoff, and 24 hours would seem to be reasonable, absent other evidence that that's too short or too long.
This is Michael. I guess I'm still seeing it a little differently, but I see this event as being you had custody, your process failed, an incompetent person got loose and was exposed to something, and let's say they were raped, you know, that week later. Now tell me whether we report.
under the recommendation of 24 hour, I suppose you would not, right?
Yeah.
Is that what
not
the,
disabled
the group
because,
is saying? Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Rape, you know, I don't know, is that important? Apparently we think that's not serious enough to report. But for me, again, going back to the event, the issue is you had custody and the custody process failed, and as a result, as a direct result, not coincidence, but as a very direct causal result of your failure to keep custody, patient suffered harm.
Yeah, but that's, Michael, this is Cynthia. I think what you're talking about is, again, the degree of harm. Is it serious disability? Does rape qualify for that? That's not the same as the 24-hour time period from the time of elopement within which you can associate the harm.
Yeah, you're totally right. There are really two different issues that I'm trying to draw attention to the fact that for me, 24 hours makes no sense. For me, the issue is direct cause. And then the reporting threshold of how serious should it be, that's still on the table.
So perhaps we take the harm completely off the table and change it to elopement for greater than 24 hours, as elopement is a continuum. If you miss somebody, somebody is out of your custody for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours, it's not as risky to them as more than 24 hours, and that's the risk that we want to know about. And we just got lucky that they didn't get hit by a truck.
Well, I'm not so sure that that fits particularly well with long-term care. Again, state operations manuals, the whole thing is taken very seriously no matter that they're gone for, you know, 10 minutes, an hour. If they are gone and, you know, you don't see them walking out the building and redirect them back, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, making this work with the previous definitions that have been used may be difficult because, you know, the unambiguous part is death, serious disability, and the time frame. So as we try to, you know, adjust some of these measures to different settings, we're running up against all these what-ifs.
Yeah, and this is Diane, and just as a frame of reference for us, we originally had a four-hour time frame. For reporting here, so it was death or serious disability associated with an elopement for more than 4 hours, and we got rid of that in our statute because we just didn't feel there was a need to set an arbitrary timeline like that. If there was a death, we kept death or serious disability, but it didn't feel necessary to say that if it was less than 4 hours and the patient died, you wouldn't report that, where if they were gone for 5 hours, you would.
And we had a lady who was at a facility, pretty competent, and she was in a wheelchair, and she was wheeling herself to the lake to drown herself. Well, the trouble is it was a pond, and she wouldn't have gotten very far, but nonetheless, it only took her 20 minutes to get there.
And that's the next one, so
yeah.
Don't jump ahead.
All right.
So, Diane, your statute now has no timeline whatsoever in it, is that right?
Correct. We have death-serious disability associated with an elopement from, how do we word it here, associated with patient disappearance, excluding events involving adults who have decision-making capacity. So we have no time limit on it, but we do retain the death or serious disability threshold.
It sounds like to me from the discussion, tell me if I'm wrong, that more people are weighing in that there does need to be a timeline, yet we still have some discussion and disagreement around what that cutoff should be. Is there consensus that there should be a timeline on this one? Not what it is, but that there should be a timeline.
I don't think so. I think there. We've already heard a number of compelling examples of cases where there was an elopement and great harm could have occurred or did occur in a really short time period or a long time period. So as Michael put it, I'm not going to fall on my sword over it, but my opinion would be to not have one.
Is the driver the clinical event again, or the elopement? And it seems to me if the driver's the clinical event, it's less important to have a time horizon. Phil Schneider speaking.
This is Helen Lau. I agree.
Okay. All right. All right. Sounds like we're unless we hear otherwise, leaving it the way it is without the timeline, because the clinical event is the driver there. I think it's pretty clear, rather than the elopement.
So what are we saying about serious disability or death then?
That's what I'm trying to scroll through a bunch of these, although I've got a printout too, that as to whether the drivers or the event or the association, in other words, is it serious death and disability associated with all of these, and then there's sort of a causative factor like elopement or that type of thing. It seems to me that the focus is on the trigger is patient death or serious disability, and then the associated with is sort of the category in which this event is placed. That's kind of the way I'm thinking about it. And most of these events are like that. So the issue of the causality is sort of a downstream analysis. It's not maybe even immediately obvious. It's like the Toyota sudden acceleration example that's been mentioned before. The important thing is that these cars are taken off. Whether it's a driver's fault or the car's fault is something that has to be determined. So,
and I'll restate what I said before. I won't say it again. We have surgery performed on any wrong body part, and that's independent of harm.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And here, that's why I kind of threw out the 24 hours, I can understand how within 20 minutes you can hurt yourself, but if we really want to understand the burden of risk that we have as a country as to whether we have people eloping and we're exposing them to risk, the number of people who really get hurt are small. The number of people who are eloping and who we're having trouble tracking down is large, and we don't have any sense of that. So, I'd love to see it flipped to, who are out of our custody for more than 24 hours. That's a very different calculus.
Well, then what about the needle stick issue? We're not suggesting every needle stick be reported. I don't know. To suggest that every elopement be reported, to me, starts to steer away from what I thought was part of the definition of serious reportable event, where there was patient condition involved.
Again, I think for this is Eric. For this one, I think from the NQF standpoint and the reporting, it probably is death and disability. And again, I'm comfortable that at the state level, with regards to survey and compliance, it's the elopement that's the important event. So it's just we either harmonize them or leave them the way they are.
This is Cindy, and I guess that I've been confused during this whole discussion. I apologize. I was associating the 24 hours with the development of the associated serious disability or death, not with the time frame of the elopement itself. Which way are we looking at it?
Cynthia, I think you're exactly right that we have before us two proposed different serious events. It's becoming clear to me that we could retain them both or elect just to have one. But we've defined, I think, pretty nicely two events. One is serious harm due to elopement, and the other is elopement for a serious length of time.
Exactly.
When the TAP recommended the 24-hour, what did you have in mind when you made that recommendation?
I think that came from Stan's TAP, and he's not here. Our TAP just asked for guidance but didn't actually pick anything.
Yeah, and our TAP didn't find it particularly valuable.
Didn't find it valuable to suggest a timeline?
Correct.
I always assumed that it meant that a timeline, and in the way that we had it in our statute, meant the length of the elopement, not the length of time between the elopement and the injury.
We were definitely talking about the time between the elopement and the injury, just about people who might elope and weeks or months later they die. And is that still something that needs to get reported? So, you know, not thinking of the 24, it happening in 24 hours, but thinking about something that might happen a long time later. And if we don't have boundaries, then there may be confusion about that.
And for us, the way that our statute was written, it was clear that it meant disappearance from a facility for more than X hours. So it was the length of time that the patient was gone rather than when the injury occurred necessarily. But again, we don't have that restriction anymore.
Well, the, it seems to me now that if I'm right, and we have these two things. One is serious harm from any elopement, and an elopement is defined as you were responsible for them and you blew it. And then the other event, the other thing is, we think that near misses in this case are not important, and we think that the real issue here is not just the extremity of the harm, but the fact that they were wandering around for 24 hours, and that's the seriousness of the lapse that we wish to measure. And as a researcher, I would say those are two different research questions, and it doesn't matter which one you choose, but they're really different. When you report them, you're going to be measuring different things.
Any other comments, questions on this one? I think you guys have flummoxed me a bit on this. If it doesn't sound like we have consensus on either, you know, whether there should be a time limit, or if so, certainly what that should be. So if that is the truth, because it doesn't sound like the consensus is shaping up on this one. Should we report it out as it is, but then include comments on our various input on the discussion for public comment about time limit and whether or not those should be two separate events?
Let's let the monkey decide.
There you go.
Trump's
okay.
Monkey.
Okay, that sounds like a good one for input on that one. Okay, let's move on to the next one that you guys already started discussing briefly, suicide, patient suicide or attempted suicide, resulting in serious disability while being cared for in a healthcare facility.
So from the physician office tab, we thought it was relevant, and our only suggestion here was changing it to healthcare setting as opposed to a facility. But we thought it was fine.
And from the SNF perspective, same thing. This does occur. It's important to recognize and included in the and the TEP is included in NQF is a good idea.
And can we put an asterisk next to disability so that it comes under our general discussion?
Do we need to talk about the clarifying definition where it says as events, defined as events that result from patient actions after admission to a healthcare facility? So does that exclude the ER?
Yeah, that would be silly.
Yeah, so I think we need to take that out. Or modify that. Make it under the care of a facility or however, whatever the language was we're going to go to for the other one.
What do other people think about the, I guess it's Tejal's TAP recommendation, but healthcare setting? Is that a better, more comfortable definition for people rather than healthcare facility? Or do people have any thoughts on that? You're okay with facility?
Healthcare setting really expands the definition, and it gets into that universe of assisted living and the rest of it, which is really not the purview of what we looked at. And but the facility does have a particularly clear definition for skilled care.
I think this is Diane. I think this is another area where I think we had discussed it a little bit on the last call. I think each state has to create their own specifications for which facilities it's going to apply to, and that would differ from state to state. And I think that they can clarify it through their own rules or statutes and make it clear which facilities it are applicable and which are not. So I would oppose changing that.
For me, the issue here is under care, not admission, really. But for the reasons we said, that some facilities don't really admit exactly. But this is like the custody thing. When the patient is under your control in some way, then it's a lapse on your part if they kill themselves, usually. I had a patient shoot herself in the lobby of the hospital on the phone with her psychiatrist. And I would say that at that point, neither the hospital nor the psychiatrist was in charge of that patient. They couldn't have prevented it by any good process on their part. So I guess what I'm grasping for here, and I don't have the language, is when there's a lapse in the care process here of a person who should have been safe, the family should have expected they were safe because they trusted you. That's the one I'm looking for here.
So you would say that would not formally apply until the formal admission process had taken place, or?
You see, admission to me is a ceremony of papers and stuff. It's different everywhere. Admission is almost a term of art here. I would like to go for something a little vaguer, like under care.
But does that under care, I mean, if somebody's waiting in an ER, a psych emergency is showing up, but waiting in the ER lobby for 6 hours before being seen and becomes despondent, and that happens. Does this capture it or not?
That's really tough. You know, that's like the person's gasping in blue in the ER waiting room. They die on the floor.
Right.
And you say, they hadn't signed the form yet, so it didn't happen here.
But I do worry about undercare, too, because, you know, you might be under the care of a psychiatrist in the outpatient setting, even though you're not in the clinic. So that term, at least, you know, I think is maybe a little too vague.
Yeah, you're completely right.
Mm-hmm. What's another term besides undercare that would be more helpful?
Custody. Come on, lawyers.
Well, who's responsible? Are you responsible or not?
Well, I think it's really, what do we want to know? And once we know what we want to collect, then we can come up with the terminology to capture it.
You know, while being cared for is in the is the current language, and I was kind of okay with that. Facility, I would change.
Is the issue for the outpatient, so while being cared for in a health care facility, is too narrow? Do we need to, I think there was some comment that can be defined state by state, which probably is the solution.
I think if you define it, it's fine. I think the issue for our TAP was that most people don't consider, you know, a little clinic with two or three docs in it as really a facility. I think facility has a little bit of a different connotation, but if, you know, in the clarifying remarks or interpretive guide or whatever, if, you know, we just say that facility is intended to cover a wider range than just the hospital, that would probably be fine.
But then do you get into, if you call it, I mean, if you say that, do you then get into whether or not a physician outpatient who commits suicide then becomes a reportable event, I mean, maybe we want that to include that, but that sounded to me to be the concern that results from this discussion.
I think what we're trying to capture, and folks can correct me if I'm wrong, is if that, you know, I mean, not that you're under the care of a psychiatrist, but if it happens, you know, on the premises of the clinic or the hospital or whatever. So, I mean, are we specifically trying to get it when it happens on the premises? So then the hospital lobby issue comes up, you know, again, too.
Ms. Melinda, may I ask a couple of questions? One is with respect to the question of healthcare facility versus setting. You got at some point a definition of healthcare facility that has been included in the last two sets of the serious reportable events that's rather lengthy and seems to address all of the settings that you've talked about and could be changed to healthcare setting without changing any of the rest of the definition. So that's one question about whether or not that would address the question of setting across all of the discussions. And the other is in terms of this particular one with the additional specifications, whether or not the question of whether the patient's under care could be resolved if you said it includes events that result from patient actions after they present themselves for care in a healthcare setting. So the patient who was standing out on the sidewalk or in the bathroom with their razor blades before they'd ever checked in for care wouldn't be captured, where the patient who had actually presented themselves to the desk to register for care would be.
It's interesting, this is one of those cases, I think, from the consumer viewpoint, where there would be two different, the definition of while being cared for, I think there's a really different expectation from the consumer viewpoint. If someone shows up to a property with an intent of getting some help, I think they would see themselves as being cared for at that point. But if you from the practitioner viewpoint, if you haven't had a chance to assess, if you haven't, done any of those things that actually begins the care process, then I think it's a different expectation, maybe. I don't know. More comments? What?
Well, I think the intent here is to minimize those that are preventable, right? So we should focus our thoughts on trying to craft a definition that will guide us to that. The being on the premises without being under monitoring and surveillance and having risk screening done, those are not preventable, even if you're in the facility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's one of the critical things here is the inception of the care process, the assumption of the responsibility for assessment and protection. I almost think that, I know that home health care and a bunch of other areas, you know, we're just ignoring them here, which is actually good. Maybe in this one, each setting might have slightly different clarifying examples or exclusions, because the waiting room of acute care psychiatric helpline intervention facility is way different from a general hospital waiting room and way different from the psychiatrist's office for a regular appointment. And we're going to have to reach in to those differences.
Well, I'm just trying to look at some notes from a discussion that we had around the question of when is someone a patient and when are they being cared for, and we haven't really finalized it, but